Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And we're back on the main course. I'm Patrick Martins, and we are on the telephone with Thomas Odermatt. Thomas, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, congratulations on 10 years in the San Francisco, Northern California food scene.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Patrick.
So tell us a little bit. Well, first tell us the items you make. You make a limited number of items. So just to put it in perspective for our listeners who have never eaten at your place, tell us what you cook and where you cook, where people can eat your food.
So my food is typically available at Farmers Market in the Bay Area, in San Francisco and around. And then I do a greater amount of catering as well. And the product is really like the meats. We have chickens, and then we have porchetta, which is a traditional Italian street food. Pork belly rolled into the loin with the skin on and becomes crispy, and we put them in a sandwich. And that's really our highlight. Then every ingredient we are using, we buy at the farmer's market, and literally, I mean, we are a mobile kitchen. We're a kitchen on wheels, so it is not a restaurant.
Right, it's a rotisserie, right? I mean, it's a thing. I mean, first of all, a middle, just for people to know, is a 35-pound part of the pig. And although sometimes Thomas wished it weighed 28 pounds, usually it weighs 35, and it is the entire loin, it's the entire belly, it's all the ribs, and it basically, you take the bones out and roll it, right? And then you put it on the rotisserie where it kind of cooks in its own juices.
Yes, it takes about 3.5 to 4 hours to cook. Of course, I could cook it significantly faster, but that's not what's rotisserie all about. Rotisserie is pretty much, let's take time to cook. That's what it is.
Yeah, slow cooking. So now, were these the same three items that you started with when you first broke into the scene 10 years ago?
No. No, when I first broke into the scene, I had only chicken, just chicken, and that was already 10 years ago. It was a nightmare to find locally grown, free-range, high-quality chicken. Literally, all they knew for rotisserie cooking here in California is, let's get out-of-state chickens, pump them up, and put them on the spit, and that's it. And kind of the supermodel, supermarket model. I never believed in that, never really liked it. So I had a really hard time to find top-quality ingredients. Today, it's significantly easier to get it with the movement. 10 years is a long time, but it's actually not long. And I'm just still impressed that 10 years we didn't have this quality.
Yeah, I mean, it's really been a recent phenomenon that, I was just talking in the introduction of my show. I mean, in the early 80s, people were eating shitty food. I mean, in the early 80s, olive oils and the French cheeses, they were just starting to come. I mean, Steve Jenkins of Dean and DeLuca with the famous cheese plate, and then, Lydia Bastianich, for instance, with Lydia's, she would bring in San Marzano tomatoes and these great olive oils. I mean, it is such a recent phenomenon, even the European imported stuff. much less the whole movement. So, Tomas, tell us, how has the farmers market scene changed over the past 10 years from the farmers to the clients?
I think what I see is that farmers market nowadays have an increasing organic availability.
Okay.
So the producers are more organic, not really corporate organic, what I call it. However, small organic certifier and small family farms. 10 years ago, we had a handful in certain farmers market. Today, that scene has changed. I also see a lot of farmers 10 years ago were not certified, were not organic farmers. They have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the customer clientele, even in the downturn, economic downturn, I have seen that people are just coming more to the farmers market. People are educated. People wanted to know where the food comes. People are reading about it. People wanted to know what they put in their mouth and who is behind. And that's what I see. And that has changed over the past 10 years incredibly.
Now, what has been your greatest challenge as someone who, you know, is very focused on doing two or three things very well right now? But, I mean, what has been your biggest challenge surviving amongst this sea of organic and sustainable and local producers making better products?
Well, that's a very, very complex question. You know, I don't have really big challenges. I do have some challenges, but they're not really overly great. I see more the other one, that I don't actually have any challenge. We create a product, we stick to it. Yes, we can change the flavor profile of the chicken. The pork, I don't touch the pork flavor profile because I don't want to change anything. And when I talk about challenge, I think in our business, literally, truthfully said, in my rotisserie, small little rotisserie business, I don't have those challenges at all, actually.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have challenges, but I mean, is it a challenge, for instance, to stick with one thing in this United States where everyone is, you know, changing the menu completely, and they were doing this and now they don't do that at all, and now they're doing something completely different? You've stuck to time-honored techniques, which is why your sandwiches and foods are considered really the tastiest maybe in all the U.S. But is that a challenge to stay motivated to do the same thing so perfect?
Patrick, now I understand the question. I think what I try to do is I focus on rotisserie. I have joy on rotisserie cooking. I am more like European chefs, European cooks, European farmers. They stick with something, they go for it. Why always change? Changing makes the whole life even more boring, makes it more very, very some. I have to worry that I come up with a product that people like. No, I love really my business model. I like to focus on the business model, but on the other hand, is I wanted to be the best. I wanted to be the best rotisserie grill master that is out there, and that's more of a European model. I am not what I always call, I'm not a springbok. I don't jump the fence. I am just what I am.
Now, what does the rotisserie allow you to do that, for instance, a grill or barbecue or any of the myriad of other methods do not allow you to do? Why the rotisserie?
I can cook everything on the rotisserie, literally everything. I can cook. I can cook really everything and watch how products develop themselves. products are very, very joyful in the grill. It sounds a little bit philosophical, but products appreciate, like for instance, a pork loin really appreciates me to give slow heat but constant heat. The pork loin would not like me to cook with 500 degrees Fahrenheit and say, okay, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. No, 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 no. That's not rotisserie. The rotisserie and the pork will tell me, take a little time, perhaps have a glass of wine, if I could. But take time. It's really time that makes the product great. Can I make a business model with it? I believe so, because I do know that I can also stage products in the rotisserie, that it takes time to gradually produce. But I'm not against hurry and let's make sales or whatever. No, 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 no. I like to make sales. I need to survive as well.
Now, do you still learn things? I mean, does the amount of skin, I love, Thomas, that with every sandwich, you always put a very healthy dose of skin on it. So it has that crunchiness, that crackliness that I love so much. But do you still, does the rotisserie and the pork itself still reveal things to you after all these years? Or would you say you've achieved mastery status after having been so consistent with the same task for so many years? It's really interesting to ask you these questions, because most people do not do the same thing for more than a few years or something. And now for 10, you've been perfecting a single item, which, you know, goes contrary to how many people think. But of course, you've truly achieved something great. I mean, how does a master still learn new things?
I think in terms of my porchetta, I think I've never learned finish yet. I'm still, every day I cook a porchetta, I still watch it. I'm still impressed that I learn every day a little bit something about the rotisserie. And, you know, it's the speed, it's the fire, it's the wind, it's the weather, it's the moisture. Mm. All those affect my output of a porchetta. The flavor profile, everybody can do that. Mm. In the whole world, everybody knows probably what my ingredients are. It's so easy. But what makes my porchetta different is that I have studied and stand in front of that grill for 10 years, and I still learn every day on it, and I'm just impressed. The sound, you know, that crackling, that when it's almost finished, how it, and I always wondering, it technically comes always the same minute, the same time, and I'm wondering why. Mm-hmm. Although they are different pigs every week, different breed, different farmer, different environment, it's the same time that they are start to crackle. Mm-hmm. Almost to the minute. And that's what impresses me, and I don't want to alter the product. I want to work with the product, learn the product. Yes, and if I need to stay another 10 years in the grill, It's okay. It's fun.
Now, let me ask, before I want to ask you about some of the big 10th anniversary events at Chez Panisse, yeah. But first I want to ask what are the most poignant or significant things that you learned from your father in Switzerland, who was also in a similar, you know, in the butchering, preparation business, prepared foods business. What do you take from him the most as you are in your 10th year?
Passion. Passion about the products. My father is a very unique butcher. He loves the farmer more than he actually loves the meat. He always said, I need to know the farmer. I need to know what kind of character is, who is he? Then I know what kind of product I will get. Mm-hmm. And we in Switzerland, in our town, we sourced everything in the town. Literally everything. I grew up in a farming town. outside of Zurich, Switzerland, and yes, we had meat, and we had farmers in that town, and that's all what my father used. He used meat from local farmers, and that I am so inspired about that. But then on the other hand, is I'm also very inspired when he touches a meat. It is like a beautiful frosted, like a musician that is creating a masterpiece. It's not the speed, it's touching the meat, understanding this product can do that and that and that. And it always keep in mind, it's nourishing, it's not show. It's not show. Meat is not show. Meat is nourishing. And the animal has grown up to nourish, and we are nourishing ourselves with that meat. And that's what my father always told me.
Does he use a bandsaw or a knife? Or both? I mean, he obviously uses a knife, but does he use bandsaws?
He doesn't use a bandsaw. No. He does not use a bandsaw. The most saw he uses is a handsaw, mm-hmm. and he does what I call joint butchery. Joint butchery is based on bones. Have your knife as close as possible to the bone as possible. Meaning, with other words, he knows the anatomy of the animal very, very well, probably better than a doctor, than a veterinarian, so that he can get as close to the bone without interacting and damaging the meat in between. Mm-hmm. So that's also, it's incredible to see. Now he is 90, but when he came here last time, he was 86, and he's in top shape. He doesn't eat a lot of meat, but he eats always a little bit of meat.
Mm-hmm. And when he cuts, he only uses the first couple of inches of the knife, right? I mean, that's correct. The sharpest part. And where you control it the most.
Correct. He holds the knife like a sushi master holds the chopstick to prepare mm-hmm. certain things. He really holds the knife very, very different. I think he holds the knife so close to the animal, to the bone, like you would use your fingernail to mm-hmm. cut the meat. It's incredible to see it, and I think that's art. I mean, my father was in the business for 60 somewhat years, actually over 60 years himself, and he did the same thing, butchering every day, meat.
Very interesting, and so that very fascinating. I could we could talk many more shows about what we just got into, and we should. That's what this network is for, is to archive these types of fascinating food stories. But to bring us to the current day, I know you have got the full city of San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley together to celebrate your 10th anniversary. I know I was introduced to you by Alice Waters, and I know that there's a big event with Alice. How was that, and how is it going, and how is everyone reacting to 10 years of Roli Roti?
Everybody's very impressed. I mean, I kind of lead the mobile food truck movement in a gourmet section, so I was really one of the first, and today a lot of people are impressed that it's already been 10 years. It's 10 years, Roli Roti. Yes, we make a huge party at Japanese with all his fathers. I am extremely proud. I'm extremely proud. I don't know what to say, but on the menu, we have heritage chicken, not really heritage, just old-fashioned birds, locally grown. And we have porchetta, of course. And we make arancini. Arancini are fried little
rice balls.
Fried rice ball, but I put them on the rotisserie.
Oh, interesting.
And they come out very, very crispy. Just know how. incredible product.
Well, I recommend everybody go. I mean, I know there's other farmers markets. You can look at the Roly Roly website. But, of course, Ferry Plaza on Saturdays is the most visited one. And whether you come very early and watch Thomas and his team set up, or if you watch the, you know, all of the washing of all the equipment afterwards, I mean, and then all the lines form. It's a real social institution, that line. And, you know, I'm a big admirer of yours, and, you know, it's really easy to say that you, it's the best, tastiest sandwich that I've ever had. So I wish you all the success and choices and all your dreams come true. It's nice to talk and sell to a master, and I think everyone agrees that you are one. So thank you for taking a few minutes to share your story, and I hope you come back and we could talk more about your father.
Absolutely, I would love to. Yes, I would love to.
All right. Uh-huh. Well, we're going to take a break, and we will come back with Danny Williamson of Good Shepherd Turkey Ranch talking about genetic diversity in poultry.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Well, we're back. Welcome back to the main course. My name is Patrick Martins. We are broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street, Bushwick, Brooklyn. And in studio is Danny Williamson. Welcome, Danny.
Thank you, Patrick.
Danny, are you? What's your title? The president, right, of the Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch?
I'm actually general manager and chief financial officer.
All right.
Yeah.
CFO and chief manager. That is no small task when it comes to the various projects you guys are working on. So tell me, why are you in town and what are you hoping to teach people?
Well, we're here to talk to people about the heritage turkey movement this year. You know, we've got Thanksgiving coming up here in about a month and a half, and so we just want to make sure that we can inform people about what they're getting with their heritage turkeys, and here to answer questions. You know, we like to get out and talk to people and let them know we're actually real people out here.
Now, what is some of the biggest misunderstandings that the public has about this idea of heritage?
Probably the biggest one is the turkey flavor. You know, we got a lot of people that ask for bourbon reds or bronze turkeys, thinking that there's a different flavor in each one of them. They're all going to taste the same. I've cooked enough of these turkeys over the years, and they're all going to taste the same. You're going to get a good flavored heritage turkey no matter which one you get.
But as long as it is heritage. Now, this term is ballyhooed a lot by a bunch of people, a bunch of different companies. I mean, does that upset you when you see that word get used the wrong way, or is that flattering to you because you were the founder of the movement?
In a way, it is flattering that people are trying to emulate us. But it does get upsetting to us when people are trying to market their birds as heritage turkeys when they're not actually using the stipulations that a heritage turkey is supposed to meet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that does upset us sometimes because Frank and I have put a lot of effort into getting these birds to where they need to be.
Frank Reese.
Yeah, Frank Reese.
So now the USDA allows only you to use the name heritage on the USDA bug, only your farm, for the time being. So where are other people putting the word heritage, and why isn't anything being enforced out there?
A lot of people are just using it in their advertising. Mm-hmm. Because actually, legally, they cannot put it on a label on their bird. You will see a lot of people advertising them as heritage birds, but when you see them in their bag, they just say turkey.
Yep, they just say turkey. So what is heritage poultry?
Heritage Poultry is actually, it was established back in the 1873 with the American Poultry Association. It's the oldest agricultural organization in the United States. It was a group of people that got together that were raising chickens and turkeys and ducks and geese and decided to get together and write a standard for what they were supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. When Frank and I first started this about 12 years ago now, there were no heritage turkey was not a definition. When we started working on this, we were calling them standard bred turkeys. Mm-hmm. And we had some people telling us that, hey, you guys should think of a snappy name to call them. Mm-hmm. So we had some people say, well, why don't you call them heritage turkeys? So, you know, we went with that flow, and it's we haven't looked back since.
Now, how do you keep up with the standards, with the looks, with what's changing out there with breeding and poultry? I mean, I take it poultry shows has a lot to do with it, right? I mean, just seeing turkeys constantly and judging, and chickens, things like that.
There are state fairs all around the United States, mm-hmm. and then there are also just poultry shows that are done at other times. I was actually just in Chicago a couple weeks ago judging a poultry show in Chicago. And just going around and looking at the birds, they're all supposed to meet a standard that was written in 1873. The standard has not changed, so the birds should look the same year after year. Mm-hmm. Probably the biggest thing is actually going out and talking to people. It's great. I've made a lot of friends in the APA, and that's part of it, is a camaraderie, mm-hmm. In raising poultry.
Now, let me ask, are there certain breeds that are really technically, off the record heritage, but they just don't fit into those 1873 standards, and so they can't really be called that?
Actually, any breed of chicken or turkey or duck or geese that is accepted by the American Poultry Association standard of perfection can be called a heritage breed poultry.
And some of these are more recent entries than 1873?
Yes. There's some that have been admitted, 5-6 years ago. Okay. There's been a lot of birds that have been admitted since the very beginning.
Now, your specialty, I believe you're a licensed judge or the highest standard of judge for the black turkey, right? And for other poultry as well?
Yes. The black turkey, I'm what's called a master exhibitor. Mm-hmm. I've won enough shows with my black turkeys to get that special recognition. And I'm actually the only person in the United States to ever hold that.
Hmm.
So that is very special to me, because that's what I started raising was the black turkeys, and they're very special to me.
They're a rare breed. How many other farmers raise those?
Probably across the United States, there's probably maybe 10 or 12 that actually raise them, but they will raise less than 20.
Wow. And I bet you know a lot of them.
Actually, I do quite, a lot of them got their genetics from me to start with.
So is there a lot of commonalities, for instance, with like the dog show, the Westminster Dog Show, that I know a lot of people watch when it comes here to Madison Square Garden? Are you looking to, when you judge, are you looking to see if each chicken or each turkey best shows, the representative features and traits of their own breed or variety?
It's exactly like that. Probably the only difference is that the birds aren't on a leash. They're in a cage. But yeah, they have the exact standard that we're looking for to make sure that they conform to that standard, not only in body shape, but in weight and color. The birds are judged on several different things to figure out which one is the best of the best.
No, very interesting. Well, I mean, it is definitely, over the past 12 years, the Good Shepherd story has been, one of the greatest revitalization or, saving of an endangered livestock species success stories, of the past 40, 50 years, and I'm sure the message has changed throughout each of those years, because, first you're trying to introduce the concept, then you're trying to reinforce certain things. So now you're coming on your 12th year. What is the message? I mean, what are the bullet points you give now about why it's important to, buy a Good Shepherd Ranch turkey?
The main thing is for genetic diversity. When Frank and I started this, there were very few of these birds raised. And the more birds that we can raise and get out there and get on people's Thanksgiving dinner tables, the more diverse the genetics will become. And the more diverse the genetics are, the better off the bird will be, and it will have a better livelihood in the end and be able to survive.
Well, I was always struck most by that comment that your turkeys survive various pathogens like avian bird flu better than the other kinds. I mean, that is a big stat right there. Well, it's an honor to have you in the city. You should come more often and be on the show more often. But good luck. You have a crazy couple months coming ahead. So thanks for taking a few minutes and coming in studio.
Well, thanks for inviting me up, Patrick.
Joe, that interesting interview, isn't it, Joe?
I never thought I would learn so much about turkeys today.
I know. Who would have thought? You were like, Mom, I've made it in life. I know all these poultry facts now. Did you know there are 10 breeds of turkey out there? Well, it's very interesting. Well, you know, Danny was in town. We also have, in keeping with our San Francisco theme, we have three well-respected Filipino chefs who are in town for a series of events to celebrate Filipino chefs in San Francisco, here in New York. So Purple Yam has organized a few events, and they have one more night available. It's the last night tonight, so if you have not made plans yet, I'm going to be giving out the number to Purple Yam on Cortelou Avenue in Brooklyn to our listeners, and I definitely think you should come and try the food of these three cats right here. So in studio, we have, of course, an old New York institution, Romy of Purple Yam, whose wife, Amy Bessa, and him, put together this event. And they have three guests, all in from San Francisco. So we have Kokoy, who is, did I pronounce that right?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, yeah, speak close to the mic. Pull your mics close. So Kokoy, who is the chef of Kokoy Culinary Services. We have Tim, who's the chef of Attic, and also has two food trucks, including the Wild Food Truck. Again, all Filipino theme. And we have a great other Filipino chef named Dominique, who's also in town. So first of all, welcome, and how have the events gone so far? I'll start with you, Kokoy.
Well, first, thank you for having us over. That's great. Well, it's really exciting to have us over and actually doing what we do here in New York. We're so happy that we have received a very warm reception here in Brooklyn.
Now, is the Filipino food different on the West Coast than it is from what you've seen on the menu at Purple Yam, or is it the same?
It's just a state of mind, I guess, and also a location. But in essence, it's all the same. It's the same passion. It's the same ingredients. The same take and the same approach we do back in San Francisco, and the same approach we've been doing here. So, it's just a matter of personal take, I guess. Yeah.
Now, where is your restaurant located in San Francisco?
I'm actually based in South San Francisco.
Okay.
I provide culinary services privately for certain clients, and also consulting in several restaurants.
Oh, very, very nice. And Tim, you came east as well for this event. How's it been going? And tell us about your restaurant and trucks.
Well, yeah, this event is great. We're very grateful for Amy and Chef Romy to put this whole event together. It's bridging the gap between the whole West Coast and East Coast Filipino food movement, because both coasts want this food to succeed or be the next emerging, Asian, Southeast Asian cuisine. And there's so much roots and culture with a lot of Filipinos all over America. It's the second largest immigrant population, Asian immigrant population, and hopefully it's about time that people you know, recognize and realize is food. And so it's great from coast to coast. We're connecting the gap, and you know, I'm learning stuff out here that you know, that they do differently in New York and Brooklyn, with meeting the other chefs out here, King from Kumai Inn and stuff like that. And it's stuff that we could take back there and hopefully, you know, return the favor to them, fly them back West Coast and, you know, bridge this whole gap.
Now, what are the commonalities between, how would you distinguish Filipino food from, let's say, you know, other foods from that area of the world? I mean, for people who've never eaten Filipino food before.
It's there's some great native food that the Filipinos have, and then also the cross pollination of the Chinese Filipino connection, the Spanish Filipino connection, and the Latino Filipino connection, and so it is a world food, and you know, it has its own personal roots, and so it's kind of interesting because, you know, Spanish food has been in the limelight for so long, and you know, Chinese food has been around forever, and you know, if people can break the stigmas and whatnot of what Filipino cuisine is and the balut's and the weird stuff and the dog eaters and stuff like that, then they can realize, they can see like the cultural influences that have been influenced on the country and how the cuisine has emerged from, and hopefully get down and deep into what their cuisine is really about and the native dishes and stuff like that. And
very interesting. And now, last question before I go to Dominic, but you just did the Eat Real Festival with your wild food truck. Was that a success? Did a lot of people come to Jack London Square?
It was a huge event, and every year it's great. Hundreds of thousands of people and all kinds of cultural food. You know, there's several Filipino food trucks, and the Eat Real. I'd suggest if anyone can make it out there, it's an annual event in Jack London Square.
Very cool. All food trucks. Very interesting. So Dominic, you're in town too. Tell us a little bit about some of the dishes that have been on the menu and your contribution and what's going to be on the menu tonight for people who still come.
Well, and some of the dishes are going to be the classic purple yam dishes, and some of the dishes that we have to offer of what we bring, kind of our sense or our take of a Philippine cuisine. Sometimes for other people there's traditional, and for me, kind of being born here in America, I have a different take on what Filipino food, kind of how it represents itself. So there's a little bit of in regards to the difference between that too, and I'm trying to understand what, you know, my take of what Filipino food is, what I read in books and what I read in kind of from different people, and you know, and I don't get that sense because I've never been kind of back there in the Philippines to understand food. So my take is a little bit just different. I think it's not bad in that way. I just try to get the flavors and the essence of what the food is, and you know, hopefully that's what I'm bringing to the table here.
Well, give us an example. I mean, give us a dish in detail, you know, with the ingredients.
So my dishes, I did a beefsteak Tagalog, which is, you know, a traditional Filipino kind of breakfast dish where it's like a sauteed meat, kind of, you know, dry, not necessarily dry, but maybe somewhat chewy sometimes because of the marinade with a lemon. So I change it up where I use like a meat. So we use a flank steak. We use the skirt steak. We just pure grilled salt and pepper, no marinade, where it's traditional in the Philippines to be marinated. And what I did was sauteed some onions or braised onions with a calamansi, which where's the traditional sense of what a beefsteak is.
What's a calamansi?
Calamansi is like a Philippine lime.
Okay.
Yeah. So and so it
is that imported from the Philippines?
Yeah, they grow it out in the West Coast. Very kind of, you know, it's a lot of backyard farmers.
Like, God, those lucky bastards. They can grow everything out there.
Yeah.
So, we don't have that luxury
so,
here.
You know, Tim would go on weekends to his, you know, his special, you know, special hiding place of where he can get a big old bag of, you know, fresh calamansi that I'd have to kind of poach from him every now and then.
It's like the Meyer lemon of the Philippines.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's Meyer lemon growing in every backyard out there.
Yeah. So that's, you know, in a sense, that's my difference. It's like, you know, I try to give the flavors of what the dish is, maybe, but in a different sense. Mm-hmm. But it's still, you know, the purity of the dish and still the understanding of the flavors and what, you know, the culture represents within that. So it's not so much in regards to like a fusion of a completely different, you know, foods, but it's the same flavor. It's just within a different setting.
Very interesting. Now, of course, there have been all these events happen. I know, Romy, you're a big a big spokesperson for you and Amy for Filipino, although Amy's a better spokesperson, but sometimes you get given the mic by force. But tell me about, I mean, are there a lot of Filipino people here in New York? And what, you know, yeah, are there a lot of Filipino people?
Yeah, there's quite a big chunk of Filipinos here in Brooklyn. Not too much in Brooklyn, but mostly in Queens.
But not many Filipino Jersey. Restaurants.
Not too many.
True Filipino restaurants. Why is that? I mean, that's an interesting... I've always wondered, because your food's so delicious, I'm wondering why more Filipino people have not opened restaurants.
Oh, this is a...
The million-dollar question.
You're too good. They'll never beat you. That's why, Chef Romy.
They're all in San Francisco. Yeah,
well, but anyway, to talk to specifically, mm-hmm. like Dominic made this heritage pork shank, and deboned it and braised it, and finally make it crisp by frying it. Mm-hmm. So it's we call it crispy pata. Mm. And then we have the lechon, from which it's not the regular spit roasted lechon. Mm-hmm. And then we also use the pork belly.
Heritage. Pork belly with ribs.
With ribs, skin on.
Bone in, skin on. You got it all on there.
And then of course the big thing that was we sold out.
Of
the goat.
The goat.
Yeah.
It is Goat-tober almost, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Goat. Yeah.
And did that work? Is goat a traditional Filipino food? I know pig is big, but how about goat?
Not as big, but it's in a certain region, for example, in the Ilocos region. That's a big thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, they grow and they survive anywhere, right?
Yes.
And how was the goat prepared? Did you pull all the meat off and prepare it one way, or did you prepare the different sections?
No, it's a whole... goat, and we spit roasted it and just marinated it in turmeric and garlic oil and lots of herbs.
Excellent.
And then we serve it with pineapple salsa.
Ah, very nice. Well, I know no event happens without a whole team and a village behind it, so there were certain sponsors, right, that made today's or this weekend's event possible?
Absolutely.
Kokoi, tell us.
Sure. Heritage Foods have been very generous in giving us meat to work with.
Never heard of them.
Yeah, the pig's ear. Thanks for the pig's ear.
Thank you for the pig's ear and also for the goat, the fantastic piece of goat. So we have a couple of them. Mm-hmm. And butterfly that thing and put it on fire in the backyard. It's uh-huh. really great. And also for the pork belly and pork sides and all those good stuff.
Very good.
And we'd also like to thank Pacific Island Supermarkets and San Francisco for providing us a lot of the tropical goods that we use in our pantry and also produce, and also the one of the very few Filipino wineries in Napa Valley, Corte Riva Vineyards, for providing us wines for pairing.
Do they make traditional, is that just Filipino owned, but they make California wines, or do they make a Filipino style of wine?
No, these are strictly California style wines, very well very well made, and actually have garnered quite a following and also great reviews for that as well.
Well, fantastic. Do you have websites that when you're not at eReal, I mean, can we go around and how sure. people can contact you or learn more about Filipino cuisine?
The contact form is available on my website.
Okay.
Kokoi.org.
That's COCOY?
Yes, the ORG.
.org, so it's a nonprofit organization.
Yes, sir.
About educating people on Filipino culture.
That's right.
Very Absolutely. Nice.
Thank you.
Tim?
AtticRestaurant.com and TheWowTruck.com, Filipino food truck.
Where can your trucks be found? You have to flag it down, or do you park
it's
somewhere?
It's pretty much all over the Bay Area. Okay. And so, yeah, the whole mobile scene, and so...
Me? No. No.
Dominic
just walk
master.
Down the street and
he's
just,
a quiet yeah. master. He's
I'm
like,
a ninja. You just got to find me.
No one knows, but he'll kick your ass in the kitchen for sure. Well, there's still a few seats left. The event's been a huge success, but it's at Purple Yam on Cordeloup Avenue, so right at the end of Prospect Park. If you want to reserve, and if not tonight, if you can't make it tonight, definitely go get a true taste of Filipino cuisine. I mean... Romy and Amy have been doing this for decades, first in Soho and now here in Brooklyn. So the number to reserve is, right, get your pens out, 718-940-8188. tell Romy if he comes out that Heritage Radio Network sent you, and you get 2% off of a beer from Philippines. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, gentlemen, best of luck. We're big fans of Filipino food, my wife and I and everyone here at Heritage. So best of luck getting the word out, and enjoy your rest of your weekend here.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thanks,
Patrick.
Thank you, Romy. Thanks. Thank you, Amy. And we'll be back next week, and stay tuned for Straight No Chaser. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.